Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker this afternoon, Ambassador Nicholas Veliotis. Ambassador Veliotis has had a very long career in diplomacy. He has had a second long career after his retirement. So that if I really wanted to hog this podium, I could for the whole hour giving you a good deal about his background. But since you came here to listen to the ambassador and not me, and since I came here to listen to the ambassador and not me, I'm going to have to abbreviate his extensive biography of achievements. He is and has had, as you will see, a rich and distinguished diplomatic career. He served in the State Department. He also served as a Foreign Service officer in a variety of places in the world. In the State Department, he was, among other things, a special assistant to the Deputy Secretary of State. He was Deputy Director of the Policy Planning Staff. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Near Eastern and South Asian Affairs, and on and on and on. In foreign assignments, he served, among other places, in Tel Aviv, in New Delhi, in Rome, in Naples. He was ambassador to Jordan, and late in his career, ambassador to Egypt. Following retirement, he served as president of the American Association of Publishers. He's a member of the Middle East Institute. He serves on the Council of Foreign Relations, of the American Academy of Diplomacy, of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, and the Mediterranean Quarterly, among others. He has served in the U.S. Army. He holds a bachelor's degree and a master's degree from Berkeley. He has received numerous honors, pages of them. Briefly, the State Department Distinguished Service Award, the Presidential Superior Honor Award, the B'nai B'rith Faith of Our Fathers Award, and he's been decorated by the French government. Ambassador Veliotis will speak on the subject of the crisis of American diplomatic capacity. I am pleased to yield this podium to our distinguished speaker, Diplomat Veliotis.
Thank you, Matt. And I must say I appreciated your restraint in the introduction. My wife, Pat, and I are delighted to be here. It's our first time in Alaska. Stopovers on official flights to and from Asia don't count in this respect. And this is the beginning of our Alaskan odyssey. I say odyssey because we are going to be in Anchorage with you, then we're going to Fairbanks, we're going to end up in Juneau, and we're also going to be able to go down to Seward and take one of your ships. And I want to truly commend your staff, Lisa and Carrie, their efficiency and effectiveness. We are living testimony to that. Just the way they were able to create and coordinate our schedules was really amazing. And I want to thank you all very much. And also to Melton Sue and Chuck Becker, who met us at the airport. We really have been overwhelmed by the hospitality that you have shown to us. And I learned that Melton and I do have one bond that is very rare. And we're a vanishing breed, is that we've both been married to the same women for 57 years. I say vanishing because nature is going to take care of us in that too. I'm delighted to be able to discuss the role of diplomacy in protecting and promoting the interests of the United States. I spent more than 32 years as an American diplomat. So my perspective was, is, and always will be, what is good for the United States. And I'm one of those who happens to believe that America is indeed mankind's last best hope, and that if we are true to ourselves, then what is good for the United States will, by definition, be good for the world. I put this up here just for you to look at. I'm not going to speak to it. I'm going to have a couple of other slides that I'll put up. I hope you have a chance to just glance at it, because it is a context in which American diplomacy works in the American democracy. And I say the American democracy because we are unique in how we govern ourselves, how we make our policies, how we implement them. Now, the U.S., of course, has no alternative to living with the world. You know, because of a variety of historical circumstances, not the least of which were the result of World War II and the subsequent end of the 45-year-old Cold War in 1990, our size, political, economic, military strength, we find ourselves in a unique leadership position among nations. It's really a moot question if we have, quote, lost stature and power in recent years. That's being debated around. These things are all relative. At the end of World War II, we were the only major nation in the world to survive without damage to our homeland and with a thriving, growing economy. With the rest of the world literally on its knees, we inherited a post-war leadership role almost by default. I was a GI in Germany shortly after World War II, and the place was absolutely destroyed. Let's remember that this did not preclude a major post-war recession. So we had our economic problems, even with our unique position of strength. And if it were not for Senator Arthur Vandenberg, the Republican leader of the Senate, and former leading isolationist, the creation of NATO and the initiation of our successful policy of containment of the Soviet Union would have been very problematical. A major diplomatic and national security triumph, of course. This was a shining example of what constructive bipartisanship can do in advancing the interests of the United States. So good things don't just happen in foreign policy, despite Mark Twain's comment that, quote, God looks after babies, drunks, and the United States of America. If only it were that easy. For 45 years, we existed in wary and dangerous coexistence with the Soviet Union, essentially a bipolar world. You recall we engaged in a number of wars and other types of military engagements, which, despite our overwhelming military superiority, we did not always win. But even losing a few on the periphery, or not winning, could not prevent our becoming, after 1990, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the world's only hyperpower, a phrase that was invented to describe us. Pretty heady stuff. Well, of course, it didn't last. It will be interesting to see how future historians characterize the last 20 years and their significance for the position of the United States in the world. A couple of prominent transatlantic professors have already tried their hands at this. Neil Ferguson of Harvard argues in an article in an early issue of this year's Foreign Affairs that we probably are overextended. And he cites the fall of Rome and the dissolution of the British Empire as examples of former empires that dissipated their resources and power by trying to do too much over too much territory. And the strong suggestion that the U.S. is in the process of following suit and is in decline. On the other hand, the British historian Piers Brendan, the author of The Decline and Fall of the British Empire, takes the opposite point of view in an article in the New York Times at about the same time, entitled Like Rome Before the Fall, Not Yet. Now, obviously, we're all pulling for the more optimistic point of view, and we're going to hear a lot more of this. This is one of the favorite themes of the pundits in and out of academia. And we all recall how wrong the pundits were in the 1980s in their predictions that the Japanese were going to take over the world. My own view is that the situations after World War II and the end of the Cold War were really aberrations. What we have seen is the economic, political rehabilitation and improvement of various other actors, the creation of the European Union. We did that. Russia, India, Brazil, and China. And as far as Brazil and as China and India are concerned, before we jump off the deep end, let's recall that China has a floating migrant population internal of 300 million people. India, for all of its remarkable success, particularly in the high-tech sector, is a predominantly rural-based society where the vast majority of the people live on less than $2 a year. Now, these things just didn't happen, and our policies aided and abetted these developments, for better, for worse. But we are going to have a lot to say about the future position of the United States, regardless of other and international influence. Which gets me to the point of my being with you today, the role of diplomacy. There are any number of definitions of this word. It's easier to say what it is not. It's not cocktail parties and striped pants. I only recall one career ambassador who really enjoyed cocktail parties and the social burdens that went along with that position. And we all thought he was rather abnormal. In today's world, in too many posts, you would find an ambassador wearing a flak jacket much more often than a tuxedo. Even back in the good old days of the Cold War, I was one of numerous ambassadors on terrorist hit lists. And in my case, security became an even more pressing issue after the hijacking of the Italian cruise ship Achille Lauro in 1985, when I was widely quoted as saying some nasty things about the terrorists who hijacked the ship and murdered an American. Our former ambassador to Iraq, Chris Hill, offered his own definition of diplomacy. Convincing people to do what they ordinarily might not do. Obviously, Chris was thinking about his very difficult task of trying to convince the Kurds, the Shiites, and the Sunni to cooperate enough to hold successful elections as a prerequisite to holding the country together and limiting Iranian influence. My favorite definition I found while strolling through the downtown shopping area of our little city of McLean, Virginia, and there in the window of the shop was a pillow. And that pillow said, "Diplomacy is the art of letting someone else have your way." There it was. I couldn't resist. I bought it. The components of diplomacy have often been described as smart or soft power. And the purpose of diplomacy, as I mentioned earlier, is simply to promote and protect the interests of the United States. Nothing wimpish about this. In fact, diplomacy should be considered the first line of defense. Matter of fact, the Academy of Diplomacy published a book with this subject a few years ago. Military force is always available. But this should not be the preferable or only option, in part because war unleashes forces difficult to control. And anyone who's ever, in my former business, worked with the military can only admire them and their gung-ho attitude. You got an objective, tell them where to go, and they go. And that's why you've got to be damn careful what you ask them to do. If it's just almost impossible, they'll do it. If it's really impossible, you can't ask them to do it, in my view. An example of what can happen when you unleash this incredible instrument called the American military in problematic circumstances is Iraq, which today is demonstrating the validity of the law of unintended consequences. Critics make a strong case that the most important result of our invasion will be the enabling and strengthening of Iran, which is our sworn enemy. Now, we can discuss all of this in the Q's and A's if you wish. For now, I'll just mention the name Ahmed Shalabi. You may remember this fellow. He was a convicted embezzler in Jordan. He's an Iraqi Shia who was promoted by Richard Pearl and other neocons as the future leader of a democratic, pro-U.S., pro-Israeli Iraq. Well, he was subsequently considered by the U.S. government to be an Iranian agent. Unfortunately, in many ways, in the past 20 years, we have too often acted as though we really believed that the fall of the Soviet Union was the end of history. That memorable phrase coined by Frank Fukuyama, who, amongst other things, was a colleague of mine in the Reagan administration in the early 1980s. He coined this phrase in the early 1990s. He's been trying to live it down ever since, but that's what he said, that's what he meant. This was a bipartisan period of unrealistic giddiness. It wasn't just Frank, which, among other things, led to a hollowing out of our diplomatic establishment at precisely the time that the major military threat had disappeared. For example, the U.S. Information Agency was dismantled. Who needed this highly effective USG propaganda arm if ideological and political history ended and the world was going to be just like us? Why preach to the converted? Let's get rid of those America houses in Germany and those cultural centers in Paris and other major French cities, for example. Who needs cultural and information programs abroad? After all, American popular culture is the rage overseas. Oh, that's fine if you want to leave people's images and beliefs concerning the United States to hip-hop and Hollywood. But I should mention that just as we were dismantling USIA, national elections in France and Germany were won by parties that ran on anti-American platforms. And one of the greatest pro-American resources in the world is foreigners who have lived or studied in the United States, or who have traveled to the U.S. under our official Fulbright and Leader programs. Post 9/11, we are making major efforts to again attract students and potential leaders to visit and study here from the Islamic world. And this is a credit to former President George Bush, whom I have criticized earlier indirectly. He deserves credit for seeing this and trying to move to take actions that would help us start to reestablish these human bridges that are terribly important. I won't continue along this line. I'll just let my friend from Jordan discuss this, should you wish. We have a long way to go to rebuild our ability to communicate with the world at all levels. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm chair and vice chair of two organizations that are deeply engaged in this important work. I should note here that the various polls that show declines in U.S. approval ratings abroad. Got to be careful how we deal with these things. Polling on these issues is very, very unreliable. But based on what we have, we fell pretty far. In popular consciousness, it's come up a bit a couple of years ago, but that's due primarily to the election of Barack Obama, and that's a reflection of the fact that, unfortunately, President Bush became a dirty four-letter word in many parts of the world. And a general belief that the United States would now be prepared to seek its interests through negotiations rather than through the use of military force in a multipolar world. We're still quite low in the Islamic world, where our major security problems are today, as well as where most of the oil is. And I'm not one of those to apologize for the fact that we care about protecting natural resources that are important to our society as well as to the entire West. We're not talking about popularity or less public hostility for its own sake, but how this impacts on our ability to achieve our goals abroad. Even friendly authoritarian governments, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, etc., have to pay attention to their public opinions. And this becomes very important when you're trying to have them let them have your way. It's worth noting here that the polling indicates the U.S. is most popular among people in two Middle Eastern countries, Iran and Israel. Go figure. But this helps explain the dilemmas facing policymakers in trying to strike the correct balance in our policies towards Iran. Yes, you want to hurt the government, but you also want to avoid harming the people. And this is a very tough thing to do. We also gutted the U.S. Agency for International Development. Now, I have always been a critic of the way aid operated. And there are good arguments for different kinds of organizational looks for AID. But can you really justify having only five engineers on the staff of an agency heavily engaged in construction of roads and buildings? The State Department and Foreign Service Officer Corps took continued hits over this period in personnel and overall resources. You know, who needs, apart from the fact that the Cold War ended, everyone was going to be just like us. Who needs embassies when we have CNN and other 24-hour news stations? Well, the problem here is that TV provides an overwhelming amount of raw information, but no considered intelligence, policy proposals, or solutions to problems. Now, it's nice to have all this information. It really isn't. It's too much information, and no one can really absorb it. But what does it mean for the United States and its policies? Well, this is where a highly trained and disciplined Foreign Service comes in. Oh, yeah, well, how about digital diplomacy? Just use new technologies to communicate our druthers to foreign governments and peoples. Well, I suspect if you try this in your business, you're going to lose your customers in very short order. Now, more money has been appropriated, but the facts on the ground mean that a lot of this money goes to security. Now, one of the dilemmas is you need more people, but if you put them out there, then you need more secure buildings and you need more security officers. We're still wrestling with this conundrum. At the same time, the Department of State had to staff many new posts which emerged from the dissolution of the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia, the so-called stands, and places like Macedonia and Slovenia and Slovakia, places that unless you watch the World Cup in soccer and basketball, you may never have heard of, but they're there, and they're in the world that we live in, and you have to deal with them. You can only transfer so many positions from existing posts and from Washington to the field without negatively impacting on a post's ability to provide service to Americans and foreign nationals that are required by law. These are consular services. You don't get away from them. If you do, you violate laws. And from a substantive point of view, the ability of the U.S. government to coordinate the activities of various agencies, both in Washington and abroad. Now, some large posts have as many as 25 U.S. agencies represented on their staffs. And one of the more incredibly labor-intensive and fruitless organizations or initiatives is trying to get an agency to say they don't need X, Y, or Z people in post Z. Policy formation and implementation is complicated and very difficult. I've handed out some charts. Which we will be addressing. And I hope you've taken a look at this. I'm not going to talk to this. But this is a general context of how policy, for policy formulation and implementation. Now, one of the casualties of our cutbacks were in training, including the language training. Now, this became a general problem, but people don't all speak English everywhere in the world. This became particularly acute as successive secretaries of state looked for the language skills required for service in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, to work with our military. Now, you can argue, and I have, the merits of nation buildings, reconstruction, and stabilization offices and provincial reconstruction teams. But if you're going to engage in some activities, you better have trained personnel, or just forget it. If I can find this transparency that I brought, that I cut out of the Washington Post, I'll put it up. It's sort of priceless. In any event, we'll go on. I've handed out some charts that try to describe the complexities of making and implementing policy. One of them, I think, building on the previous slide, what we're talking about, again, is making and implementing U.S. policy in the increasingly multipolar and often dangerous world in the context of the American democracy. Policy in Washington usually is not formulated by a small group shielded from the realities of our society and political culture, and then dictated to a waiting country and a waiting world. This worked for Nixon and Kissinger in China. But this is far from the norm. Policy formulation and implementation is complicated, difficult, and continuous. My old boss, George Shultz, used to grumble when summoned to yet another National Security Council meeting on the same subject. Is nothing ever settled and decided around this damn place? A recent study of American negotiating behavior by the U.S. Institute of Peace estimates that in the context of any negotiation with foreigners, 80% of U.S. energy and effort goes into negotiating among ourselves. Myself, I was asked to address a crowd of about 150 newly arrived diplomats in Washington some years ago, and to help them become accustomed to what it's going to be like for them to live and work in Washington. And so I chose as the title of my presentation, Foreign Policy Formation and Implementation in Washington Has Little to Do with Foreigners. Well, there were gasps around the room when I started. I don't know if I had any impact. I don't know if anyone learned anything. What I do know is I was never invited back. The U.S. has over 268 foreign service posts abroad, 191 embassies and consulates accredited to countries, and must also work with the multitude of multilateral organizations, the bulk of which are in the U.N. system. Some of these organizations are superfluous. There's one in Vienna called the UN Organization for Industrialization. I never understood it. Fortunately, it's very small. But too many of them are very important and require our attention and our resources. We all know about the UN General Assembly, the Security Council, the Organization of American States. But let me cite a few lesser known. The World Health Organization. Ebola, anyone? The World Intellectual Property Organization. The International Telecommunications Union. The World Trade Organization, Interpol. The United States Nations Conference on Trade and Development. The Counterterrorism Committee of the Security Council, the International Monetary Fund, World Bank, International Civil Air Organization, and of course the International Atomic Energy Agency. This is not airy-fairy work. It's of great importance to us and our well-being. And all of these international gardens have to be tended. And let's take a look at how the U.S. negotiates in this increasingly multipolar world. The U.S. Institute of Peace study mentioned above is a truly unique analysis entitled American Negotiating Behavior. It's part of a series studying such behavior by a number of important countries. It includes articles by Americans experienced in negotiating with foreigners and foreigners experienced in negotiating with Americans, what we think we are doing and how others see us. The study lists four mindsets of U.S. negotiators: practical, businesslike, pragmatic, seeking to achieve concrete results; legalistic, desire for clear binding agreements; imperialistic, impatient, tendency to seek quick results based on U.S. power position; attitude of superpower hegemon, which of course we are; moralistic, tendency to sermonize, project U.S. values into negotiations; idealistic, lecture from position of moralistic superiority. It also lists five factors influencing negotiations: issues, personalities, the structural process of decision making and negotiations, the real world situation, the geopolitical situation, and the cultures involved. Now, the study is not a blueprint for success, but it will be useful for those who wish to understand the approach of the U.S. government to negotiations, and for those who will be conducting the negotiations in an increasingly complex, interconnected world. I found it fascinating as I projected back into time, into various negotiations in which I was involved. And it should set to rest any preconceptions people may have that when the United States talks to other countries, even bad guys, that somehow that means we're making concessions, that the mere fact of talking or negotiating means preemptive capitulation. How you negotiate without talking, I don't know. But we're pretty tough-minded about what we do and how we go about it. Now, I said the study is not a blueprint for success, and it's not always possible to follow what you would like to have happen. For example, consider the desire for clarity and legalistic binding agreements. One of the most important and successful diplomatic negotiations in recent years was carried out by Henry Kissinger in China when the U.S. and China agreed to the Shanghai Communique, which was and is a masterpiece of constructive ambiguity, which simply finessed the two China's policy. It just lumped them into a two China, one China, Taiwan linguistic, artistic mishmash, which remains the basis for U.S.-China relations to this day. And the study concludes that the scale intensity of interagency debates in the U.S. puts the United States in a league of its own. Quote, Americans negotiate with no one as relentlessly and passionately as they negotiate with themselves. Now, in order to highlight our diplomatic deficiencies in personnel and resources, in 2009, the American Academy of Diplomacy and the Henry Stimson Center in Washington prepared a report entitled Foreign Affairs Budget of the Future. Lisa, I think you've got copies of this report. I'm not overwhelming you with figures and things like that, but you might want to take a look at this. Pentagon, amongst other things, it called for 1,300 new state and aid officer positions and the creation of a ready reserve which could be deployed in crisis situations. And this report was well received by both the Bush and Obama administrations and the Congress. It was endorsed by 8 former secretaries of state and supported by Secretary of Defense Gates and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen. Basic theme being, you need more resources for a renewed and more robust diplomacy. The 8 secretaries of state included the following points in their letter of support. National security is more than about bullets. Diplomacy, soft or smart power, needs more resources. Avoiding one war or defusing one major crisis would save many times the required increase in these resources, in addition to saving American lives. And they ask for an increase over several years that's less than 0.5% of the defense budget, and this excludes the cost of fighting the 2 wars that we're engaged in. And they recognize that our national security demands greater engagement on a number of relatively new and dangerous issues, failing states, terrorism, climate change, spread of infectious diseases. And at the same time, the challenges presented by managing bilateral relations, even in a multipolar world, are becoming more complex and require more time. And fixing the problem of resources will require a sustained effort over several years. I should note here that the military bands have recently come under attack. I don't know if you've seen these articles. And the Secretary of Defense actually has had to respond to press questions about this. Military bands, the budget is larger than the budget for the entire Foreign Service Officer Corps in the United States. Now, Congress has approved a lot of the resources, and that's where it stands now. If I've not convinced you to rush out and insist that your elected representatives fully fund State Department budget requests, I hope at least I have added to your understanding of and appreciation for the vital role of diplomacy and how it is practiced in our democracy. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll take some questions.
I have 2 questions. We have several students here today, and at the end of your piece it says, so you want to be a Foreign Service officer. What can you say to encourage this career choice for some of the students? And then my second question is, being a diplomat, how does our huge amount of foreign debt affect our diplomacy? Has it helped us dictate it or beg for it or something else?
Well, let me take your second question first because it's the easiest to answer. It has an enormous impact on our ability to promote and protect our interests abroad. This is what we're talking about. I never lose sight of that. On the Foreign Service, of course, I'm prejudiced. I am in favor of Foreign Service careers. I'm not one of those who looks back on the good old days and say everything's gone to hell since I left. The world has changed. America has changed. The Foreign Service has changed. The requirements have changed. If anyone is interested in this, it's very simple. Go to the website of the State Department, state.gov. and start informing yourself. There are several ways to get into the official U.S. government foreign affairs agencies. One is by examination. The most of the major positions in the State Department at senior levels held by career people are held by career foreign service officers. So if you aspire to that, I'd suggest you go through. And if you want to make it a career, I suggest this is the way you go. Now, there are pluses and minuses. For us, we were a tandem couple. We both wanted it. Patty is a musician and a teacher, so she could take her profession with her and she could exercise it wherever we were, in Vientiane, Laos, or in Rome, Tel Aviv, Jordan. There are disadvantages. You have to weigh this carefully. It's the spouse. Does the spouse want to do it? If not, don't go or don't get married. There are distances. You will be apart from each other at times. Health problems. It's one reason why very few Foreign Service officers, female or male, are accompanied in sub-Saharan Africa. The health situation has gotten worse, and educational opportunities have deteriorated. So you have split families, primarily because of the children. And there is a problem. You've got to really be careful about the disruptions, the gypsy-like life. Some kids thrive, others do not. The ones who thrive usually thrive if their parents have had, let's say, three assignments in the same language and cultural area. These are issues. Gender is not an issue. When I came in, they probably wouldn't have hired you if you were a woman, and if they did, if you ever got married, you'd have to resign. Now, I was part of a movement that we turned this around in the 1970s, but that's not a consideration, not at all. If anything, if you're a woman, your chances of passing the oral exam are probably better than men. I hate to say this to the boys out there, but at this particular point in time. So, if you're interested, look into it. There are other avenues. There's a vast nonprofit called the NGO world, non-governmental organizations, that do good work out in the world.